I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and it is time now for our cover story. Today we're looking at preservation, exploring what we choose to preserve and how music and art and literature are changed by the efforts to conserve and preserve them. This is a question that deeply concerns my special guest today, radio producer David Isay, who has spent much of his time in radio producing stories about preserving memory, preserving physical space, and artistic endeavors. David is the founder of Sound Portraits Productions, and you may have heard some of his amazing documentaries on public radio, including Ghetto Life 101 and the absolutely mind-blowing Sunshine Hotel. David is currently producing the Yiddish Radio Project, unearthing and retelling the story of the golden age of Yiddish radio. David, welcome to Studio 360.
Hi, Kirk. Good to be here.
Well, let's start with an excerpt from one of your most recent pieces, the documentary Witness to an Execution. We'll hear from the Reverend Carol Pickett, who has witnessed the execution of almost 100 inmates at Huntsville in Texas, here describing what it's like to spend the last few seconds with a condemned prisoner.
After they're strapped down and the needles are flowing, and you've got probably 45 seconds where you and he are together for the last time, and nobody can hear what goes on there. And the conversation that took place in there were, well, basically indescribable. It was always something different. The guy would say, "I want you to pray this prayer." One of them would say, "You know, I just want to tell you thank you." One of them would say, "Don't forget to mail my letters." Another one would say, "Just tell me again, is it going to hurt?" One of them would say, "What do I say when I see God?" You've got 45 seconds, and you're trying to tell a guy what to say to God.
That was an excerpt from Witness to an Execution by David Isay and his collaborator on this project, Stacey Abramson. Why did you decide to do this particular project, David?
Well, I mean, I think that the way I go about most projects is this window opened and we leapt through it. I mean, we had this opportunity to get into the Walls Unit at Texas where these executions happen, and the staff was willing to open up to us and talk to us. They'd never really talked before about this stuff. So we went down and did it. It was sort of one of those kismet things.
Why were they so open?
All we did was ask. I mean, these guys, as far as they were concerned, everything in this story is absolutely true. I mean, the warden is thrilled with it. Everybody down in Huntsville is thrilled with it. This is what happens. They do these executions. It's hard for them. Nobody likes to do these things. And, you know, I think they felt like they'd have an opportunity to tell their story the way that they, you know, felt was true, and tell it with some kind of semblance of dignity, and that their words weren't going to get mangled. And that's what happened.
And it captures beautifully, I think, the ambiguity of their role. And it is not a screed against the death penalty by any means, but one can't listen to it without thinking of the price that it performing the death penalty exacts from these individuals and, by extension, I guess, all of us.
Absolutely. And another thing that we were hoping to accomplish with this piece is to kind of lay out what exactly happens in the Texas death chamber between 6 o'clock and 6:20 p.m. almost once a week now. You know, no execution has ever been filmed. No execution has ever been taped. The only physical documentary we have of an execution is the famous Daily News photograph from 1928 from Sing Sing Penitentiary, when a reporter lifted up his pant leg and snapped that picture of Ruth Snyder, a woman who was being executed. So part of what we did with these folks who do this week after week after week is just lay out, you know, detail by detail, exactly what happens in the death chamber, and kind of shine a light on this hidden part of America, which is kind of our mission.
Well, you do shine lights on shadowy parts of America, whether it's flop houses or snake handlers or the execution halls of Texas. How did you enter this world of radio?
I was 22 years old, and I was headed actually to medical school. I was at NYU. And had graduated and was in medical school, but postponed for a year because I knew that's not what I wanted to do. And I was kind of teaching, tutoring college kids on psychology, what I majored in, and psych statistics and all this sort of mathematical stuff that I was pretty good at. And one day I was walking through the East Village, and which was the neighborhood that I've lived in for a long time now here in Manhattan. And I passed a storefront that caught my eye. There was something just really folk arty about it. It was like this 12-step recovery kind of store where they have you know, different stuff about addiction recovery and alcoholism, but it wasn't like corny at all. There was something really kind of magical about it. And I went in the store, and it was run by this Puerto Rican couple. And the two of them were recovering heroin addicts, and they both had AIDS. And this was 88, so they weren't going to live for too long. And they took me to the back of the store, and they showed me this plan for a museum that they wanted to build to addiction. And they had kind of meticulously built it out of tongue depressors and toothpicks. And it was this amazing, like, 8-story model. And then they pulled out these blueprints of every floor of the museum and every exhibit of the museum. And it was just spectacular. And they were planning, they believed they could raise the $10 million they needed to build this museum. And it was just extraordinary. It was just, it was really magical what they were trying to do. And they had all these letters from Donald Trump and all these folks who they'd written to, writing them back saying, this is a wonderful project. I'm sure you'll get the money. I'm not going to give you the money, which they took not as a form letter, but as a letter of encouragement. And they thought they'd eventually get the money. Anyway, they totally blew me away. And I went home that night, and I'd never listened to public radio or heard of public radio or community radio. I just started going through the Yellow Pages, the television stations, and calling all the local television stations and pitching the story to them, saying you should do a story about this couple, and everybody said no. And then I went to the radio stations, and I started calling the radio stations, and everyone said no until I got to our beloved WBAI here in New York, which is a community radio station. And I called WBAI, and I said, here's a story. And they said, it sounds like a great story, but we don't have anyone to do it. Why don't you do it? And I grabbed a tape recorder and went to record these folks' story. And it was one of those magical moments where the minute I pushed play and record on the tape recorder, I knew, like, everything else went out the window. Medical school was done, and I'd found the thing I was going to do for the rest of my life. And I was so lucky to find that at 21 or 22 years old. 22 years old, I think I was. And I went back to BA. I cut the story. And that night, someone from NPR happened to be driving through Manhattan and was listening to BAI and heard the story and picked it up, and it was on All Things Considered the next week. So it was kind of this crazy week of events, and I was
hooked. And now you're 12 years later, you're a renowned radio genius.